From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with rock musician, singer, and songwriter Todd Rundgren, who's also known as a wizard record producer. Also today, I talk with detective writer Sarah Paretsky. Her new novel, Bitter Medicine, continues the adventures of V.I. Warshawski, one of the genre's few women private investigators. Book critic John Leonard reviews Robert Stewart Nathan's new mystery, The White Tiger. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward shows how the record industry tried to cash in on the summer of love. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Todd Rundgren. He's a composer, musician, singer, and record producer, who's also a pioneer of synthesizer and studio production techniques. He's recorded with his bands The Naz and Utopia, but many of Rundgren's albums have been solo outings where, with the help of multi-tracking, he plays most of the instruments and does all the voices. He's also produced albums for other performers, including Patti Smith, Grand Funk Railroad, Hall & Oates, The New York Dolls, and Meatloaf. Recently, Rundgren has branched out into TV and film work. He scored several installments of Pee-wee's Playhouse and is now working on the new series. He also did music for episodes of Crime Story. And Joseph Papp recently commissioned him to compose the music for a stage version of Up Against It, the screenplay Joe Orton wrote for the Beatles in 1967. We're going to talk about those new projects in a little while. First, we're going to talk about his recording style. And by the way, Rhino Records is reissuing on CD all of his albums that were on his Beersville record label. This recording that we're about to hear will give you an idea of why Todd Rundgren has been called the Wizard. All the voices on this record are Todd Rundgren's voice, and even the sounds of the instrument are his voice put through a synthesizer. From his album A Cappella, this is his song, Something to Fall Back On. That's Todd Rundgren, who's joining us now from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Todd. How are you?
Fine. And how are you?
Yeah. It's amazing you did all the voices on that. You were really one of the first people to use state-of-the-art studio production to do all your own work on a record. And I wonder why you wanted to head in that direction.
It was kind of a sideline to my production. When I first started, when I left the NAS, I didn't really intend to make records of my own. I wanted to produce other people's records. And at a certain point, I got a little itchy to experiment in studio, and that was kind of the accidental beginning of my solo career. I put together a record and only expecting it would be kind of a sideline. And fortunately or unfortunately, there was a hit single on it, so I wound up having to repeat the act many times over.
Is it enjoyable, or at least does it give you a feeling of control to do it all yourself? It seems to me it would give you the opportunity of totally acting out your vision. You don't have to worry about whether someone plays the line you wanted to hear. I mean, you're doing it all yourself.
In a certain sense, it's mostly to accommodate the kind of creative the kind of way that I write songs. I usually work in the studio, and it's more difficult to have people sitting around waiting for you to come up with the next verse or the bridge to a song than it is to just do it at your own pace and let the machines sit around and wait while you think.
You started doing this kind of solo production technique on comparatively primitive equipment. I'm thinking it's primitive recording technology compared to what's available now. You started doing this in the late 60s, early 70s. What were some of the technical challenges it provided for you and some of the artistic ones?
Well, in terms of playing the instrument, the greatest technical challenge is playing the instruments. It's not so much the sounds or the studio techniques, particularly if you're engineering it yourself. It probably looks a little comical. I should probably put a time-lapse camera in the studio sometime to see what it's like, especially when you have to do something like play the drums. And I got the drums set up downstairs, and my control room is up a flight of stairs. And every time I get through a take, I have to run upstairs to check it out. And if it's wrong, I have to come down and do it again. Or if I get halfway through, I have to run upstairs and rewind the tape. It gets a little bit slapstick at times. That's probably the greatest challenge. I've never been particularly cowed by the technical aspects of recording.
Do you think in a way that sampling, the new kind of synthesizer, has made studio production too easy, has made it too easy to do what you've been doing for so many years? Make a whole record with just one instrument?
That part was always relatively easy. The hard part is writing songs, and there aren't any machines to help you do that right now.
Do you enjoy concerts? I know you've done a lot of concerts with your bands as well as concerts as a solo performer. Do you enjoy concerts, or would you rather be alone in your studio without an audience watching?
I don't play as much probably as some people do. I get a couple of weeks in every year or every half a year. Right now I'm in the midst of what is for me a relatively long tour of about 2 months. So touring it's not that I don't like to play in front of people. It's just that I don't like to be away from my from what I consider to be my more creative environment, which is at home, where I can work on music and other projects and accomplish a lot more things. Being on the road, you only accomplish one thing a day, and that's playing a show.
Todd Rundgren is my guest. You mentioned your songs. Let's talk about your songwriting. Now, you were writing and recording a lot of pop songs in the late 60s and 70s when you started your career. And I'm thinking that that's a period where psychedelic music was considered the really hip music to be playing and listening to. And your music was, in a lot of ways, much more pop. And I wonder how that was received at the time, and if you were made to feel out of step with what was really hip and relevant.
I presume you're referring mostly to sort of the Nas days. Psychedelia was soon replaced by heavy metal and disco music, I guess, by the time we got into the early 70s. But yeah, the Nas was based on a nearly anti-psychedelic concept. I didn't particularly believe that you should make music that required a special circumstances to enjoy it, you know, that it had to transcend the circumstances. It's not that it was consciously pop, it's just that it was certainly devoid of a lot of that dependence on a certain lifestyle in order to make it successful.
You've written songs about a lot of different subjects, and you don't only write love songs. Love songs are usually the staple of lyrics. Has that been intentional? Do you want to have a wide variety of subjects in your songs?
Yes, it is intentional. I'm my own biggest fan. I like to listen to my own records, and therefore I don't like to be bored with them or think that there is some lackadaisical motivation behind them. I stopped writing those kind of songs many years ago because I realized that I wasn't writing that subject matter because it mattered to me so much, but because it was standard operating procedure for anybody who was making records. And I decided that in order to make myself feel like I was doing something worthwhile, I had to cover some ground that somebody else hadn't already trampled to death.
I want to play a record that you made called Onomatopoeia, and this was, I think, from an album in around 1978.
This is Herman of Minkalo. Yeah, this is certainly your unusual lyric subject matter.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about producing this record? It's really a lot of fun.
Well, the only...
To listen to, anyways. I don't know if it was fun to produce.
It was fun, but it... Of course, it utilized more conventional techniques than people have available nowadays. I suppose nowadays somebody might sample all the effects instead of actually doing them live. These most, for the most part, were either sung live along with, or expectorated live along with the rest of the music, or else they were put onto quarter-inch tape and edited and flown into the music.
And our listeners will hear the sound effects that you're referring to in a moment. My guest is Todd Rundgren, and this is his record, Onomatopoeia.
Onomatopoeia, every time I see ya, my senses tell me hubba, and I just can't disagree. I got a feeling in my heart that I can't describe. It's sort of lub, dub, lub. A sound in my head that I can't describe. It sort of zoom, zip, pick up, pick, drip, ding, dong, crunch, crack, bark, meow, whinny, quack. Onomatopoeia in proximity, rearrange my brain in a strange cacophony. I get a feeling somewhere that I can't describe. It sort of a sound in my head that I can't describe. It's sort of whack, whir, wheeze, whine, sputter, splat, squirt, scrape, clink, clank, clunk, clatter, crash, bang, beep, buzz, ring, rip, roar, wretch, twang, toot, tingle, thud, pop, plop, plunk, pow, snort, snuck, snip, smack, screech, splash, swish, squeak, jingle, rattle, squeal, boing, honk, boot, pack, belt.
Todd Rundgren doing his song Onomatopoeia. What's interesting, you know, you've been very popular for a long time. You've had a few hits, but you don't usually top the charts yourself. And I wonder if that would be important to you. It sounds like you're more interested in just independence and being able to write your own songs and produce them the way you want to, perform them the way you want to.
Yeah, more or less. I'm really happy that there's a Madonna, you know, who all the crazy people can pay attention to. So that I can I can make my music in peace. Thank you.
Your career is expanding beyond records, and I'd like to talk about some of the current projects that you're involved in. Now, one of the things that you're doing is writing music for the new series of Pee-wee's Playhouse shows, and you wrote music for several of the first round of programs. How did you get involved with writing music for Pee-wee's Playhouse?
When Pee-wee put together his show, he asked several of his musician friends, Danny Elfman and Mark Mothersbaugh and myself amongst them, if they would contribute music to the show. And we all consented and we all contributed music. I was just one of the, I think there were four composers involved. And over the course of the season, I did four episodes, I believe.
What kind of work do you typically have to do?
What
kind of work do you typically have to do? Do they send you the video without music or just a script?
You get a videotape with time code and no music on it. And at least as regards Pee-wee's show, there isn't even spotting notes. They just make a few suggestions about a part that they might think is especially weak and needs something, and then the rest of it is just totally up to me or whomever.
So they don't even tell you where they want music. You just decide where it goes.
Essentially, yes.
Did you watch a lot of kids' TV when you were young?
Let me see now. I used to watch Soupy Sales, Lunch with Soupy Sales. That was my favorite show when I was a kid.
Yeah, I still like that too. But thinking if music from those shows ever stuck in your mind.
I don't recall that music. A lot of music from those shows stuck in my mind. No, most of them were pretty crappy.
Right. Well, I want to play some of the music that you wrote, and for Pee-wee's Playhouse. And this segment that we're going to hear comes from the second episode of the first round of Pee-wee's Playhouse. It's the one where he wins dinner for two at a Hawaiian restaurant. And this is toward the beginning of the episode when he gets a call from a TV game show host, and he's got to answer the question that the game show host calls him with. What I really like about that segment that we just heard is you have these wonderful fractured takes on quiz show music, and what sounds to me like a fractured version of the Jeopardy theme, and your take on the inspirational Rocky theme after he wins the dinner for two.
Yes, it was a case history in plagiarism. Yeah, the kind of, you know, that a lot of times you, when you're doing that kind of thing, you can make something sound, even though the notes are all different, put it in the same kind of framework as a different piece of music and make people think of the other one, you know, without actually having literally stolen it.
Well, there's so many musical cliches that we all know from TV, and there's even ethnic musical cliches, like you have some really corny Hawaiian music that you use in there. I really like it when people know how to work with those cliches and subvert them and make them very funny.
Yeah, I'm a big subverter.
Todd Rundgren is my guest, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Todd Rundgren. He's a composer, musician, singer, and record producer who's now also writing music for television and Broadway. And he's on a tour now. He's speaking to us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. I know a lot of musicians feel very displaced by synthesizers because they think if it weren't for synthesizers, they'd be playing in orchestras or bands for TV and movie soundtracks. And I wonder what you think about that. You're probably one of the people who those musicians resent.
I think they're kidding themselves, myself. You know, the point is that the budget is the budget, and you use whatever you can afford in the budget. And people think that all of a sudden, you know, all these people use synthesizers on records, you know, to make string sounds and horn sounds, that their alternative would be they would hire all these musicians to make the string and horn sounds. That's wrong. They won't hire the musicians to make the string and horn sounds because they won't spend the money to do it. I enjoy using regular musicians and do often, but I certainly wouldn't, bust the bank just to use other musicians, for instance, to imitate some kind of a little bit of string slush or atmosphere, when you could just as easily do it with a keyboard.
You were commissioned by Joseph Papp, the theater impresario, to write a score for Up Against It, which is a musical that the late British playwright Joe Wharton was writing as a vehicle for the Beatles. I guess the Beatles were going to write songs that fit into this play, and Wharton died before the project was completed. How did you get into this project?
Well, Joe Wharton had this mini revival about a year or two ago with a couple of his plays becoming successful on Broadway. And so somebody in Joe Papp's office came up, his name is Tom Ross, but he came up with this property that Joe Wharton had been preparing for the Beatles. And at first they wanted it to be kind of like pick up where they left off and have it be Beatlesque, but I suggested that people nowadays who live through it may have a certain nostalgia, but most people who didn't actually live through it don't really care to live through it or care to relive it. So it was better to just approach it as if it was a Broadway musical and not even worry about the Beatles connection.
So you're not writing music in the manner of the Beatles?
Absolutely not.
It's interesting because when one of your records, what you did was try to duplicate the sound of the Beatles, to do their records as if it were them. But
yeah, well,
yourself.
We got that out of our system.
Right.
it's one of those things you can only do once, and hopefully it won't become too big an albatross after doing it once. I suppose it was instrumental in getting me involved in this thing, because the original concept had something to do with Beatles music, and that was why they asked, was because of that that faux Beatles album. But I don't really want to do that more than once.
You said that you got it out of your system trying to do music that sounded exactly like the Beatles. When you were younger, were you influenced by each album that they did? Did your style start changing with each album that they brought out?
Well, I didn't start writing songs until after I stopped listening to the Beatles, which was sometime around Sgt. Pepper. I thought that Sgt. Pepper was a precipitous fall from the previous album. I thought it was kind of self-indulgent stuff. I enjoy listening to it now, but in a certain way, it took what was originally... it was kind of interesting. The Beatles were, at first, they were like... When they got to Revolver and they started making comments about how popular they were as compared to Jesus and things like that, I mean, I thought that was kind of a dopey thing to say, but their music, to me, justified it. And it also still belonged to, you know, it had a particularly, you know, like we as kids owned it in a certain respect. Then when they came out with Sgt. Pepper, it just kind of, to me, was, they had sort of watered down everything so that to make it accessible. And even though there's supposed to be a lot of experimental aspects in there, when George Burns started covering the songs, I started to think, no, I'm not interested anymore.
George Burns started covering their songs?
You know, of course. He did a version of When I'm 64,
oh,
you know,
of course,
and everybody's,
of course.
You know, doing,
right.
Everybody's doing She's Leaving Home. You know, everybody's trying to see what Beatles songs they can cover. And, you know, and it's... then everybody started doing like sycophantically everything the Beatles did, you know, regardless of how ridiculous it was. Everybody wanted to get into transcendental meditation, and I thought it was just, at that point, it was over for me. You know, it was just too over the top.
You know, a question for a lot of people who play rock and roll is, does the music change and does your attitude toward it change as you get older, since we all used to think of rock and roll as teenage music? And I guess for you, part of that, the answer to that question is diversifying.
Well, it's partly that, and I think we're also bound to misunderstand music that youth that youth gravitates towards. You know, I was just talking to Willie the other night, and he said he attended an Anthrax concert to see one of our old road crew doing the lights. and it makes you really feel old. You know, see, like, you know, see all the kids just like out there vomiting at each other, you know, playing music at 150 decibels and, you know, slam dancing and stuff like that. And you say, what the hell is the matter with these kids? You know, in my day, we were wearing Edwardian suits and wore like, styled our hair. You know, we figured that that's the that was what outraged our parents, and it seems tame by comparison. But you know, I think we're just destined as we grow older to misunderstand these musical phases that are coming behind.
What was it like for you when you became a rock star when you were still really pretty young? Did you were you prepared for that amount of attention, and did you feel like you had enough charisma to to keep it up?
Well, I think I was cynical enough to deal with it, but I wasn't prepared for what the for the reality of what the music business was like. It's not the fans' fault, you know, like if they do or don't buy your records, you know, it's never their obligation to buy your records, but the things that go on behind the scenes are pretty weird and sleazy. You know, you attract a lot of creepy people who have little to do with the actual creative part of making music.
Who are you referring to? People in the industry or strange fans who attend?
Mostly people in the industry side of it. You know, promoters, slugs from the union who come up, you know, trying to collect their, you know, their little dues and stuff like that, and all these people who just, you know, who are just like barnacles great big barnacles on what is supposed to be a creative industry.
How do you get free of it? Or do you?
Well, you don't get free of it. You don't function in this industry unless you find a way to accommodate it one way or another. But I kind of like have straddled a certain area since I don't demand it. I don't demand anything from my record company that they make me a hit or anything like that, then that means that there's less demands on me. And that's the way I prefer it.
A lot of your old records are being reissued now on CD by Rhino Records. Are you listening to them as they come out? Do you like to listen to your records?
I don't like to listen to the older ones. There's some I can handle that are a little more recent, but the old ones are like baby pictures. You know, it's your butt hanging out.
Okay, Todd Rundgren, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem.
My guest has been composer, musician, and record producer Todd Rundgren. His earlier records on the Bearsville label have just been reissued by Rhino Records on compact disc. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actor Dennis Franz. He played Lieutenant Norman Bunce on Hill Street Blues. This fall, he'll star in a spin-off series titled Beverly Hills Bunce, so I hope you can join us. Here's more music written and performed by Todd Rundgren. This is Can We Still Be Friends?
We can't play this game anymore, but can we still be friends? Things just can't go on like before, but can we still be friends? We had something to learn. Now it's time for the wheel to turn. Grains of sand, one by one, before you know.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Sarah Paretsky, one of the few women writing detective novels about a woman private investigator. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward has another trip back to the summer of love. This time, a look at how the record industry tried to capitalize on the explosion of psychedelic music. And book critic John Leonard reviews The White Tiger, Robert Stewart Nathan's new mystery set in Beijing. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. Iran appears to have succeeded in nearly closing down the Strait of Hormuz. Shipping sources say traffic through the strait is down by 90% since last night, when Iran began 3 days of naval maneuvers. The BBC's Tim Flewellen has details.
The Strait of Hormuz was reported by shipping officials to be nearly empty of normal shipping as the Iranian maneuvers got underway. One source said the traffic was a tenth of normal. At least five commercial vessels did sail through and were apparently not interfered with, though one, a British-registered container ship, was followed for a while by an Iranian frigate. At dusk, most ships were still waiting either side of the strait to see what develops as the thousands of Revolutionary Guard naval units and volunteer militiamen begin the so-called martyrdom exercises. Iran says the Revolutionary Guards and volunteers have set up bunkers and other defenses along the Iranian shore of the Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and the Strait, and that mock engagements have already taken place.
The BBC's Tim Flewellen. The American-flagged Kuwaiti tanker Gas Prince sailed through the strait with its U.S. escort before the maneuvers began, and Pentagon officials said they may decide to keep the tanker Bridgeton in port in Kuwait until the maneuvers are over. President Reagan may be planning to offer a new policy proposal concerning Central America. House Republican leader Robert Michael broke the news to reporters after a GOP leadership meeting with the president.
Within another day or two, maybe you'll have a little bit more information, and I'm not privileged really to divulge that as yet. It has to do with maybe a new initiative, and I think maybe very significant.
Michael indicated that the president's initiative may be revealed at the Central American summit in Guatemala this week. He said it is fair to say it's something about Guatemala. The Federal Communications Commission voted today to scrap its 38-year-old policy requiring broadcasters to air all sides of controversial public issues. The vote was unanimous as the commission declared the so-called fairness doctrine to be unconstitutional. It said it will no longer require broadcasters to comply, but will continue to require that they serve the public interest. An Environmental Protection Agency survey released today reveals high levels of cancer-causing radar gas in many of the homes tested. The survey covered more than 11,000 homes in 10 states, and the results indicate a potential nationwide problem. Radon is an invisible and odorless radioactive gas caused by the decaying of uranium underground. Dangerously high levels of radon were found in 21% of the homes tested, and EPA officials say every state showed some homes with extremely high radon levels. Solo mariner Jim Dixon gave the thumbs up and set sail from Newport, Rhode Island today in hopes of becoming the first blind person to sail across the Atlantic. Dixon has a $12,000 talking computer on board to guide him, but he took a Braille compass along just in case. Dixon says he's nervous now, but after a few days, he expects to have the time of his life.
I'm going to be going out and having a lot of fun, and I think that it's pretty clear that my reason for doing this is that the state of the disabled in this country is pretty bad. And it's very important that each of you really understand the issues.
Dixon plans to make the trip to Plymouth, England, in about a month. The House set up its own commission on AIDS today. The bill's sponsors say the commission is needed because President Reagan's recently appointed panel has too few AIDS experts. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 10 points to close at 2546.72. In Washington, I'm Ann Bozell.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward is back to continue his series on the music of the Summer of Love. This time he examines how the record industry tried to market their version of psychedelic music.
Believe me, the one thing the record industry hates is being behind the times, and the one thing it always is out of it. I remember picking up a copy of Billboard, the Bible of the record industry, in the summer of 1967, and reading an article on the front page about how kids were abandoning rock and roll for polka. This was just after I'd come back from San Francisco, where I'd gone to shows at the Avalon Ballroom and other psychedelic dance halls, and heard some mind-blowing music, none of which was polka. Of course, the record biz was located in L.A., and to most of the people in it, San Francisco could have been a continent away. The San Francisco bands, like the Moby Grape or Big Brother and the Holding Company, were notoriously uncooperative when it came to getting groomed for stardom, but that was okay. The kids who bought records in Podunk, Iowa, wouldn't know the difference anyway. The record industry could sell the Summer of Love without getting anywhere near San Francisco.
All across the nation, such a strange vibration.
It's not fair to pillory Scott McKenzie for singing a song like San Francisco, Be Sure to Wear Some Flowers in Your Hair. He was just a guy with a voice. After all, none of the people in the business saw it as being any different than selling surfing or Hondas or any other youth fad. It wasn't even the worst song about the phenomenon. Ever hear of Marcia Strassman? Get that out of here. The Flower Children, fortunately, wasn't a hit, and I suspect Strassman went back to musical comedy or something. But there were records that acknowledged some of the Flower Children's problems, like this one.
Shoulder.
Jefferson Handkerchief's I'm Allergic to Flowers wasn't a hit, but at least it had a sense of humor. Stu Mitchell didn't.
Talking mindless riddles, and I search to find life's key. I steal to keep my need alive as it devours me. The price of wealth and boredom with a life that was given me. 'Cause I live in a house on Nowhere Street in a town called LSD.
Acid was another quickie exploitation song about an LSD addict, and its catalog of horrors also went unnoticed. If you're picking up a pattern here, you're right. Even in Podunk, Iowa, kids were smart enough to weed out most of the junk aimed at them, except when, as in Scott McKenzie's case, it spoke to their yearning. The realities of the Haight-Ashbury could be plenty grim, but at least America's flower children wanted to hear them sung about by people who'd been there.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is detective novelist Sarah Paretsky. She's one of a growing number of female detective writers who are bringing women detectives into the genre. She's just completed her fourth novel about V.I. Warshawski, a former Chicago public defender turned private eye. V.I. is as tough as some of Chicago's worst neighborhoods, can hold her own in a fight, and packs a gun. When I spoke to Sarah Paretsky, I asked her what intrigues her about detective novels.
One of the things I think is that in an age where the New Yorker runs nothing but minimalist fiction, we're really looking at a form that still tells a story. And I think that contrary to the popular trends in mainstream fiction, that many people still like to read a story.
When you read mysteries or detective novels written by men, how did you feel about the women characters and how they were portrayed?
What you see over and over again, especially in hard-boiled fiction, you have a woman who comes in, is deceptively, sort of virginally beautiful, and yet ends up being the main bad character. And what you're seeing is a woman who is sexual, and because she's sexual, she's evil. And the man has to overcome her evil through really physically conquering her, and he may also sexually conquer her. Another way that women often are portrayed in this type of book is as the opposite, that is, the woman who does behave very chastely, and yet what happens to her is that she can't solve her own problems. She doesn't generate evil the way a Bridget O'Shaughnessy does, but she can't fix what goes wrong with her.
One of the ways in which your novels differ from the traditional mystery novels as opposed to the hard-boiled novel is that in the mystery novel, when there's a woman detective, she's usually analyzing the situation, discovering clues, solving the mystery, but she usually doesn't get physically involved. She doesn't get beaten up. She doesn't carry a gun. Not the Agatha Christie type of detective. But your detective, V.I. Warshawski, carries a gun and gets involved in fights and knows how to fight back. Why did you want to actually put her into the action like that?
I think it's the kind of story that I'm telling, Terry. If you look at the hard-boiled story versus, say, the classical, the Peter Wimsey or the Miss Marple, to pick the woman character kind of story, your detective really is detached in that classical kind of story. But that type of story also depends on a certain way of looking at life, and it says, hey, you know, people generally work together for justice. There generally is a well-defined social order. Murder upsets that social order, and the detective, acting as kind of a deus ex machina, comes in and makes everything tidy. Well, the hard-boiled world says, you know, basically the forces of justice are just as corrupt as everyone else around them, and that's the famous Down These Mean Streets essay that Raymond Chandler wrote. And if you live in Chicago, you have to realistically say that the kind of story you're going to write had better be with a hard-boiled detective who's really able to get down in the muck. She has to be able to defend herself, and that in part means carrying a gun, because even though she's very fit, no fit woman is a match for a strong man in good physical shape. And a gun sort of can help her lower the odds in a really extreme confrontation.
It was not just any gun you have her carrying, a Smith & Wesson.
Well, I guess that seems like just such a good American gun to me. I always think of Frankie and Johnny. You know, she took out her Smith & Wesson and taught that bad boy a lesson.
Did you have to learn a lot about guns in order to write these novels?
I didn't know enough about them when I started writing them. A very nice police sergeant in Chicago has taken me down to a firing range and shown me how to use the model gun that VI carries. And even though she carries what I found as the lightest model in the Smith & Wesson catalog, I still could not pull the trigger on the double action part. It takes a lot of strength in the tendons going up your forearm to squeeze a double action trigger. So I realized how much fitter VI was than I am.
Would you just basically describe the character, your detective, VI Warshorsky?
VI physically is about 5'8". She weighs about 135, 140 pounds. I wanted to make her relatively large for a woman because I didn't want to have to deal with how a 5-foot-tall, 100-pound woman would handle physical attacks. VI is the kind, she looks like the kind of person that cheers you up when you see her because she's very healthy. She's not stunningly beautiful. She's not a Meryl Streep. And she looks good. She looks healthy. You like to look at her.
Can I ask you to read a section in which your heroine, the detective, gets involved in a fight?
I was mentally off balance and saw a tattoo coming only a second before he hit me. I rolled low off the chair onto his legs, upending him in a crash against the desk. I kept rolling and bounced to my feet. Pink Shirt was on me, trying to pin my arms. I kicked hard against his shin. He grunted, dropped back, and tried to slug me this time. I took the blow on my forearm, came in close, and kneed him in the abdomen. Tattoo was behind me, grabbing my shoulders. I relaxed in his hands, turned sideways, and slammed my elbow into his rib cage. He loosened his hold enough that I could wriggle free, but Sergio had joined the fight. He yelled orders to Pinkshirt, who seized my left wrist. Sergio tackled me around the waist, and I fell ungracefully, with him landing on top of me.
What are you basing your knowledge of this kind of fighting on? Do you have any experience with it?
I hate to say it, but I kind of imagine it and make it up. I'm very much a physical coward. When someone tried breaking into my husband's in my house a couple of weeks ago, when this kid broke in the middle of the night and we heard him and down in the hallway, I went screaming out the back door, trying to get the police. And then the next day, I thought, could such a wimp really write VI's adventures, you know?
What does that bother you? I mean, you're writing it. You're not supposed to be living it.
Right, V.I. is my fantasy. She can look after herself. I think, God, if that punk had broken in and into her house, she would have taken out her Smith & Wesson and taught him a lesson.
Do you get a lot of letters from women detectives or police officers who've read your books?
No, I've heard from one woman detective who told me that she does criminal work in Boston, and she said the life of a detective is really far other than what I've depicted, but that she liked having a chance to see a woman in fiction who was a private investigator. For the most part, though, the people I hear from are just ordinary readers like me who've read the book and respond to it in some way.
One of the things you've probably had to think about while writing your novels is what exactly are the physical differences and the emotional differences between men and women. Have you come up with any new ideas about that?
I guess the thing that's of interest to me is in what ways does the fact that I'm a woman unconsciously influence the way that I'm writing my books? Carol Gilligan, I think her first name is Carol, wrote a book called In a Different Voice about the way that women think and react in comparison to the way men do. And she says that for women, connection is very important. For men, separation and autonomy. But one of the things that I see about VI is that she really does live in a world of connection. When I started writing my first book, I made her an orphan because I knew in the conventions of the form that the hard-boiled detective was a loner and didn't have relatives around. But I found, actually, as I continued my writing, that she has a lot of friends, people that she interacts very closely with, and that relatives keep popping up out of the woodwork, or old neighbors, or people like that whom she's responding to. So that I think, in a way, unconsciously, my view of life as a woman has made VI operate far other than the typical male loner hero.
Thanks for talking with us, Sarah Paretsky.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry.
Sarah Paretsky's new detective novel is called Bitter Medicine. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What do you have for us on today's program?
Final reports today on the Iran-Contra hearings. A look back at 40 days of hearings, 250 hours. What did they mean and what difference did they make? We've also telephoned some of our listeners to ask their views on the hearings. And we'll play for you more songs sent to us by listeners inspired by the Iran-Contra hearings.
I understand you were up very early today to look at some unusual art.
Yes, I was up before dawn to witness the takeoff of three flying sculptures, hot air balloons. They're brightly colored fantasy creatures, and I spoke with their creator, Austrian sculptor André Heller, and there'll be a report on that.
Thanks. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Robert Stewart Nathan's new novel, The White Tiger, is a mystery set in China in the city of Beijing. Our book critic John Leonard says it's good summer reading.
They're comparing The White Tiger to Gorky Park. At least 24 novels in the last 5 years have reminded somebody of Gorky Park. What it means is that an American writer sets a murder mystery in a foreign capital, and a foreign cop investigates, and we're led to believe that the foreign society, no matter how exotic, is just as greedy and corrupt as we are. Actually, I thought Gorky Park fell apart in the last 100 pages. The White Tiger has more brains and stamina. Instead of Moscow, the city is Beijing. Instead of Russian, the cop is Chinese. His name is Hong, and all he wants is peace of mind. But his parents have been disgraced by the Cultural Revolution. His wife wants a divorce. His brother is making too much money on the new capitalist road. His mentor dies a suspicious death, and his boss wants him to handle a ticklish spy case when he'd rather be looking for hijacked watermelon trucks or the owners of illegal pet dogs. The truth, of course, is subversive. Hong will have to go back almost 50 years to the original heroes of the Chinese Revolution, with Mao in Yunnan, at war simultaneously with the Japanese in Chiang Kai-shek. To find the murderous traitor, Hong must deal with doctored photographs, tapped telephones, laboratory experiments on human memory, the missing bones of Peking Man, the Red Army, some red herrings, and a pirate. There is the usual rough stuff. There is some fine police procedure. And there are angry jokes. Hong's friend Boda, a sculptor, tells the weary cop, "So now, after the four modernizations, we'll have the five desecrations, art, humanity, architecture, work, and housing. Then we'll have the three clarifications and the seven exterminations and who knows what else." But most of all, there is Beijing, splendidly evoked. I don't know how much time Robert Stuart Nathan spent in China. It doesn't matter, any more than it mattered how long Joan Didion spent in El Salvador. He writes it down forever. And we see the temple columns and the courtyards, the red flag limousines and the yellow-canopied petty boats on little lakes, the great halls and heavenly gates and cement obelisks and Stalinist high-rise apartment houses, crickets and pear trees and gossip and smog and women behind masks on trucks with cherry-picker ladders spraying the locust trees in the class struggle. Like Moscow, like Rome, like New York, it is an imperial city, and Hong can't leave it even when it breaks his heart. The White Tiger thrills, but it's more than a thriller. Hong's traitor, just like the Red Guards in the Cultural Revolution, seeks to obliterate the past. But the past, like the repressed, comes back to get us in our dreams. We are the past, even and perhaps especially in China.
Our book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed The White Tiger, a new mystery novel by Robert Stuart Nathan. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with photographer Eve Arnold, whose new book features her photographs of Marilyn Monroe. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new reissue featuring Arturo Toscanini conducting music by Hector Berlioz. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will chart how the word impact, always a noun in the past, has been given a second life as a verb. This is a report sure to impact on your writing and speaking, so I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KSJN AM in Minneapolis, St. Paul. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.